I Eat Green with Bhavani, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another afternoon at the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green, and I welcome you to join me for this next hour as we talk about what's going on in the news, as we talk about some delicious recipes, and as I bring on a very special guest today, Jim Embry from Lexington, Kentucky, who is a wonderful man that I met when I was in Italy at Terra Madre, and he's a real community organizer, and I will tell you about him in a little bit and introduce him. But before I do that, I just want to talk to you a little bit. First, I have to say, you know, can't get used to the nights getting dark so much earlier. I'm driving in from Long Island, and you know, it's already dark when I'm pulling up, and it's just so weird. But anyway, I guess that's what we do with daylight savings time, although I think that's something we might want to reconsider now that we don't have so many farmers happening. That's the original reason why they did this. But anyway, I have two recipes I'd like to share with you today. One is a tempeh vegetable stir fry, and the other one is a risotto with saffron. And both of these recipes are vegan, and both are delicious, and they really lend themselves really well to this time of year. So I'd first like to start with the tempeh recipe. And tempeh, for those of you that don't know, it's a fermented soybean product. And because it is fermented, it's very good for your intestinal flora, and it's very high in B vitamins. So as a vegetarian, B vitamins are something that we always want to be mindful to get enough of, and this is a great source of that. And then, of course, if you cook this dish in a cast iron frying pan, you are also upping your iron level, so that's a really good thing as well. So tempeh is an interesting food because so many people who have tried it don't like it. And one of the reasons is because of the fermented quality to it, it has a little bit of a blue cheesy taste to it. And so I myself, who loves tempeh, I only love tempeh if it's really cooked crisp. And in order to do that, I actually take the block of tempeh and I cut it in half horizontally before I cube it, so that each cube is a little thinner than if you were to just cube it directly out of the package. And that allows all the surfaces to really get golden brown before you add it to the stir fry, and it makes the flavor much more enjoyable. So you want to take that one cake of tofu, cut it down the center horizontally, then cut it into quarters, and then cut each of those quarters into little cubes. And then you're going to need an onion, and you're going to cut those into little slivers, crescent moon shapes. Two carrots, and sometimes I cut carrots, you know, depending on my mood, you can cut your carrots into matchsticks, so you can just slice them on the diagonal. Or one way that I cut them, which is very common in macrobiotic cooking, is actually cut it on the diagonal and then roll it a half a turn, and then cut it again, then roll it a half a turn. And this kind of allows many facets to the piece of carrot. And not only does it look beautiful, but it releases that much more energy into the food. So cutting your carrot that way is really wonderful. One head of broccoli cut into flowerettes. And also, I do use the stem. It's one of my favorite parts of the broccoli. But in order to use the stem, you need to cut the outer layer of the stem off. Otherwise, that's very tough. So, you know, you cut the stem into one big chunk and then trim the edges of the stem off before you slice up the stem. Then you want one acorn or butternut squash. And those squashes, they are difficult to cut. You need a really good sharp knife. You need to scoop out the seeds, and then, I peel them, both the butternut and the acorn squash. So in many stores, you can buy it pre-cut, and if that makes your job easier, go for it. Just try to find organic, in all the vegetables that I'm talking about. Organic is certainly the way to go. So I know at Trader Joe's, I know at Whole Foods, they do carry already pre-cut squashes that are organic. Then a cup of string beans, really just a handful. I never really measured to see if it was a cup, but you want about that much of string beans. Some peppers, red pepper, yellow, and orange, a mixture. So you have a total of one, so you can use a half a red. I put them in mostly for color, but they also do give a nice flavor. 2 to 3 portobello mushrooms, and 1 8-ounce pack of white mushrooms. You want some ginger in there. About an inch piece should do it. And you're going to grate that. Then 4 cloves of garlic. And you can even up that to 6 if you like a lot of garlic, as I do. We're going to use olive oil or safflower oil. 3 tablespoons of tamari. And that's also to taste. 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil. And that is different. Dark sesame oil is different than regular sesame oil. Regular sesame oil, sometimes people cook with. Dark sesame oil is really used as a seasoning. It's very flavorful. And so when you, it should say dark toasted sesame oil on the bottle. But when you take the cap off and you smell it, you really get a strong whiff of sesame seeds. That's what you want. 2 tablespoons of Aji Marin, and that's a sweet rice wine. Be careful to make sure that it is sweet rice wine. You do not want to pick up like a Kikkoman mirin, which is really just sugar water. So look at the ingredients, make sure that what you're getting is really just a sweet rice wine. 2 tablespoons of organic tahini, 2 tablespoons of toasted sesame seeds. And then you're going to serve this with either organic rice noodles or brown rice or whole wheat noodles, really whatever you'd like. But soba noodles are great with this, udon noodles, any of those would work. Okay? And you're just going to cook the noodles up according to directions or the rice. And, if I pre-cook the noodles, to keep them from sticking, you just want to put a little olive oil on them or brown rice oil. I'm sorry, sesame oil. And let it just sit on the side until the rest of the dish is cooked. But that will prevent the noodles from sticking together. Okay, so you cut the tempeh as I described earlier, and you're going to sauté that in your cast iron frying pan until all sides of the tempeh are golden brown. And you might even need to individually turn each little piece of tempeh to get it just right. But it's worth it. Okay, then you're going to cook the rest of the vegetables in a wok. You're going to cover the bottom of the wok with some oil. When the oil is hot, you're going to add the onions, the squash, and the carrots. You always want to add your root vegetables first, and then the hard squashes as well, because they all take a little longer to cook. And give them like a 5-minute head start before you add the other vegetables. To this mixture, you can add the garlic and the ginger. And continue cooking at a medium-high heat, stirring constantly. You don't want to let the garlic burn. You can add more water if it seems to need more liquid. If you want to keep the oil content down, you can also add a little water to this and allow the vegetables to steam a little bit. Once these start becoming partially cooked, then you can add the broccoli. Cook that for a little bit, then add the string beans, stir for a few more minutes, then add the peppers and the mushrooms. And basically, you're always adding the vegetables in according to the length of time that they take to cook, so that they all end up being done, a little bit al dente, all at the same time. Okay? You can add a little more water or oil at any time if it's necessary to give the dish a little bit more liquid while you're cooking it. Then you're going to add the mirin, the Aji Marin, and the tamari. Stir a little bit longer. Then add the sesame oil and the tahini. And once you add the tahini, you want to add a little water, and that will make a sauce right there in the wok that you can then add the noodles or the rice right to, if you'd like, and mix that up. And then taste it. You can add some more tamari, some more dark sesame oil for taste, and then garnish it with some toasted sesame seeds and some chopped parsley or cilantro for garnish. And that is it. Very simple, very delicious, really a great dish. Okay, and the other dish I wanted to share with you was a saffron risotto. And saffron is a really great exotic flavor, and it's a flavor that we don't get to taste very often because saffron has become so expensive. So treating yourself to real saffron is a real treat, and it works wonderfully with risotto. And risotto, most recipes for risotto call for a lot of Parmesan cheese and butter, and it's a very rich pasta dish, even though it's really a rice, but it's served like a pasta. The saffron is a different flavor, and you can really get away without using any of the butter or the cheese. And so it just makes it a little bit lighter, and it's equally delicious. So you want to cover the bottom of a heavy saucepan with olive oil. The ingredients that you need is risotto. And there's many different varieties of risotto, and you can try whatever variety you like, although I do try to get the organic one. You need about a teaspoon of saffron threads, a quarter teaspoon of ground cardamom. Now, you can also use cardamom pods that you just saute and then you remove it after you cook the risotto. You don't want to bite into a cardamom pod. It really doesn't have a nice flavor to it. But the flavor of cardamom, when you don't bite into it, is quite delicious. So I use the ground cardamom. One onion chopped. Two cloves of whole cloves, 1/3 cup white wine, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 2 tablespoons of fresh cilantro or parsley, and 6 cups of hot vegetable broth, and then some salt and pepper to taste. So you cover the bottom of the saucepan with olive oil and saute the onions until translucent with the whole cloves. And if you're not using ground cardamom, you would also add the cardamom pods at this time and saute them. Meanwhile, you're going to soak the saffron threads in the hot vegetable broth and just let that sit on the side. And we're going to add the hot broth to the risotto when it is time. So you add the risotto to the onion mixture in the saucepan and you continue to cook for a few minutes, making sure the risotto is not sticking to the bottom of the pan. Add the white wine. And then add some of the hot broth, 1 cup at a time. And you're just going to add the broth and stir it and, you know, wait till the broth is absorbed. Then add some more and continue in this fashion until all the broth is used up and the risotto is soft. That takes about 20 minutes. And you're going to add salt and pepper to taste. And, you know, if you wanted to, you can add a little bit of honey to the liquid to make this a little bit sweet, if you like that. I prefer not, but I know in my saffron rice, I do make it a little bit sweet, and that works really well, so it's up to you. You can add some fresh cilantro also to garnish and to taste, and that's optional. So that's it for the risotto. And now I would like to introduce to you my guest, who is Jim Embry. And as I mentioned before, he is someone I met when I was in Torino, Italy, at the Terra Madre Slow Food Conference. And Jim is a photographer who lives and works in Lexington, Kentucky. He's a social activist, and he fights for racial equality, and his leadership on issues of environmental sustainability has been really tremendous. And he's the founder of Sustainable Communities Network and of the Bluegrass School and Community Garden Network. He also co-authored a book called The Sustainable World Sourcebook, and he's involved in documenting African-American history. So, Jim, are you there?
Here, dear heart.
How
Great
are
to
you?
Be here with you. I'm wonderful. I'm in Kentucky. It's kind of cold down here, about 7 degrees, but it's a lovely day, and I'm just so thankful and blessed to join you today and all of your listeners on Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you. You know, I just have to share with some of my listeners some of your quotes on your website because I just love them. So,
certainly.
You know, the first one is from Dr. Martin Luther King, and it says, "Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. It comes only through the tireless efforts and passionate concern of dedicated individuals. This is no time for apathy nor complacency. This is a time for vigorous and positive action." And I just love that. It's as true today as it was then. And,
absolutely.
It's so important. Another one, even older, is Albert Einstein's. "We shall require a substantially new manner of thinking if mankind is to survive." Beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes. Yes, I think both of those individuals were both visionaries in their time, and their work, both in quantum thinking. Oftentimes, when I'm speaking, I will try to encourage people to move beyond Newtonian thinking of that we're all separate, we're disconnected, and to think quantumly is a real critical leap that we have to make in our just philosophies and ways of viewing the world, that we're all interconnected, we're all interdependent, and that all of these relationships are sacred. So I have been saying, as folks ask me to give myself a title or a label, I'm now saying that I'm a sacred earth activist.
I love that.
And that means that the sense of sacredness is between all of us as human beings, but it's also relationships with all the other life forms and what we call non-life forms on this earth and within the cosmos. And that when we have a sense of sacredness between all the earth community, what we call the human people, the air people, the water people, the plant people, the animal people, then that addresses all the various social movements I've been involved in for the last, say, 50 years. And back in 1964, when I was about, I think maybe like, 15 years old, I helped to organize the March on Frankfurt, which is our capital, that Dr. King led. So I had a chance to meet him in 64.
Wow.
And, was of course inspired by his, again, vision and leadership. And with the issues around what we call climate change, global warming, peak oil, water scarcity and so forth, then not only are we needing to, provide a much accelerated work around what's called the human social problems, but these issues and problems with the ecosystem, I think, are even more demanding that we, as Dr. King says, just, accelerate our efforts in whatever we're doing. So, yes, great quotes.
Yeah, they are great quotes. And, when I was talking to you about what we'd like to talk about, one of the things that you said was quantum thinking. And,
yes.
For those that don't know what quantum thinking is, as you said, it's the interrelationship between everything. So we're also used to thinking linear. Thinking,
yes.
In one direction you take this step and then you go to the next step and then the next step. And so many people don't have the vision that everything is interconnected. And one of the things that I love about being an activist around agriculture is that agriculture really, really is such a perfect tie-in to show the interdependency between all the different things that are issues of today, whether it's health,
yes.
economy,
yes.
sustainability,
yes.
the environment,
yes.
the ecosystem, as you said. They're all connected. And agriculture is one way that
yes.
it makes it really easy for people to see the connection.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I tell people when I'm speaking that I feel that this whole work within what's called food systems, whether it's agriculture in a rural setting, or urban agriculture, or community gardening, or school gardening, it's all related to food systems. In my view, that is the most important work of this century. Because as you were saying, through the growing of food, okay, it's the place, it's the environment where human beings can begin to restore this sense of sacred earth connection, okay, with not only the earth as soil, but the earth as water, and the earth as fire and so forth. So that's why I work so much in the whole area around urban agriculture, but also supporting the local regional farmers. That was why I went to Italy for Terra Madre.
Wasn't that a great time? Wasn't that great?
it was such a... I called it, deliciously wonderful, spiritually fulfilling.
When people ask me what it's like, I say it's like being at the United Nations for the
exactly.
Olympics and
exactly.
and Woodstock all together.
Oh, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Right? Because
yeah,
you got to leave
yeah.
that. There has to be that
yeah.
Little
yes.
flavor of Woodstock
yes.
in there.
Yes. Oh, it is. This time, I was over there in 2008. This time, I flew out of Lexington, Kentucky. I flew into Detroit Airport. I met a few friends, actually, who were in the airport who were going as well to Terra Madre.
Uh-huh.
And people I didn't know. Then we flew into Amsterdam. And so us five were walking then, changing, of course, gates to the flight to Italy. And ran into a few other people.
Yeah, I flew into Amsterdam also.
Okay. Yeah, and we picked up a few other people who were also going to Terra Madre.
Uh-huh.
So now we're about, 15 strong, okay,
uh-huh.
on the plane. And then, we get to Torino, and there are people converging out of the baggage claim to go to the Terra Madre desk. And by now, it's 100-some-odd people
right.
all walking together. It was, that was just an amazing experience.
Right.
But yes, we feel that also what I'm saying, I'm speaking a lot, is that if we go back and we take a look at what has provided this leap in human development, and we say that agriculture, when human beings and historians say that women developed agriculture, when we did that, it provided a tremendous leap in human development. It helped us understand or project what it means to be human, because we who are on the radio now, and you're a radio, I call you a radio DJ, radio MC, or I'm an activist, or whether you're, a police officer or a doctor, we can be it because someone else is growing food while we're out doing other kinds of vocations and careers, okay? But the whole development of agriculture was very critical to our whole human development. So we think it's very important that everyone grow something, okay? We all eat, but to restore these sense of sacred connections, we feel that everyone, regardless of what you do in the daytime, in terms of your job, your career, everyone should grow something, because it's also a way for human beings to literally recreate what we call creation.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a chance to take a seed, put it in the ground, that small seed become this huge plant, whether it's a tomato or an eggplant or an apple tree or whatever. We get to reenact in a small way what we call creation. And it's very important.
Yeah, well, it's always so amazing when I work with somebody sees a seed for the first time and they look at that seed and they almost can't believe that from that little seed is
yes.
going to come a big plant with vegetables that they're going to be able to eat. They almost like don't believe it, and you have to prove it to them that it
yes,
that
exactly.
it really does work.
Exactly. Let me add one more thought, if I can, Ravani, because you mentioned this whole question of integrated system thinking, quantum thinking, and people tell me all the time, well, Jim, I can't think that way. It's too difficult to put my arms around, my hands around, thinking about things as systems. And I says, well, our human bodies already do that. We're on the phone talking now, but while we're talking, all of our systems are working, our kidneys are working, our intestines are working, our heart is beating, our lung is beating, okay? So I advise people, we have an innate wisdom that allows us to act and function as a system. So our task is to tap into that innate wisdom that's already there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're already operating quantumly. But we've been taught through, and I say that back 50 years ago when Einstein, Max Planck, and others developed what's called quantum thinking, that what happened, the school systems, the school structures, whether it's K-12 or higher education, never changed the curriculum and didn't change the structure of how we get taught, even though we were given this new science called quantum thinking, quantum physics, quantum mechanics. So we're still, based upon the old Newtonian, Cartesian view of the world paradigm within the school structures.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I always loved about Waldorf education is instead of being taught just in a linear, like, you know, in ninth grade you do earth science, 10th grade you do biology, 11th grade chemistry.
Uh-huh.
Instead of that, every year in the Waldorf education, they're doing a little bit of each of those so that you're building on it. And as you're learning the sciences, it's showing you how all the different sciences are interconnected throughout the whole time so that earth science is not separate from biology and chemistry.
Absolutely.
But that's
how
it's taught in regular traditional schools. And in Waldorf, it's just a little bit closer to reality, I think, the way things are taught.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. And it's so important that we give our young people this foundation of how systems work. And that's why gardening can do that. We work with kids who are 1.5, 2 years old that can't read or write,
mm-hmm.
but they can understand not to fear, you know, bees and butterflies and ants and worms. They can learn how to plant things, how things grow, how to work together. You know, we have a number of similarities. My kids all went to Montessori school, and just this about 4 years ago, the school my kids went to, we bought about 10 acres of land that we're building. We built this new middle school on because in the Montessori thinking, education ought to be land-based.
Mm-hmm.
Where the young people are always outside making things and growing things. And also I helped form about 40 years ago what is in Lexington now called the Good Foods Co-op. And I've been involved in that since the last 40 years. And I met Dick Gregory in 71, and he helped convince me the need to become a vegetarian and you know, do meditation and yoga and all kind of things. So my capacity to do what I do now as an activist and to work every day with this, you know, great sense of joy and fulfillment comes because of this this background around good food and the sense of effort around, you know, meditation, and has been just a real blessing for me to do what I'm doing now. Absolutely.
Well, I actually would love to backtrack a little bit. We only have a few minutes till we're going to take a break, but I do want to have you share with everyone what you do in Lexington. So I know you founded the Sustainable Communities Network and also the Bluegrass School and Community Garden Network.
Right. Well, you know, I wear probably about 8 different hats here in Lexington because, you know, I met yesterday, Bhavani, in Frankfort, our capital, with the governor's wife. Her name is Jane Bashir, and she and her husband began about a year ago. It was called the Governor's Garden. They followed the lead of Michelle Obama, who began, of course, you know, the garden at the White House.
Right.
And as we were talking, she said, "You know, Jim, you're the only person I know of that knows what's going on in about every sector of your community, and you're involved in most every sector." As you were saying, I helped found what we would call the Bluegrass School and Community Garden Network. That was our attempt to create a blog that's interactive with all the individuals in our region, the bluegrass region, who are involved in school and community gardening. But we have about 300 or 400 people who are involved, even those around the state, you know, much further away than just the region.
Uh-huh.
I'm also on what's called the Interfaith Alliance. My work is also trying to get the faith community to be much more active in what usually is called creation care, or being better stewards of creation.
Mm-hmm.
So I work with all the different denominations. Okay, you know, I've given retreats to Catholic women. I've given homilies or sermons at the Unitarian Church, Jewish synagogues, Islamic temples. Trying to, again, encourage the faith community to be much more involved in this work towards sustainability. I sit on the local climate action plan team. We're in the midst of writing a climate action plan for the city of Lexington that we hope will be adopted by city council sometime this spring. I'm also part of a restoration project for a historical cemetery here in Lexington. I'm always, you know, writing and researching books, especially around African-American history and contributions to the city from our community. So I've given a lot of talks and speeches, and I do a lot of work with the judicial system, also to gardening, with kids who are in detention, our kids who are locked up. We have a whole program around restorative justice, working with kids, especially those who are in detention because of drug use or drug selling.
Uh-huh.
So we do a whole program with young people.
I'm sure you're familiar with Alice Waters' project with prisons, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. She's a very dear friend. I visited out there at Berkeley two or three times,
uh-huh,
actually, and she's been to Kentucky about three times as well. And I saw her, of course, at a Terra Madre, and we hugged and things like that.
Right.
So again, I wear about, 8 or 9 different hats. I'm on the local, the government sponsored environmental commission. And within that commission, we work a lot on the issues around water. Okay. Water quality, stormwater issues, trying to reduce the amount of water that gets used, but also trying to improve the water systems. The EPA came to Lexington a couple years ago and said that what you all have in terms of stormwater and sewer water don't meet EPA standards, and we had to go through and do some restructuring of our infrastructure, if you will,
mm-hmm,
on the whole question of stormwater use.
Right.
So I've got my finger, you know,
in a lot of things. Well, I'm going
to,
when we come back from our break, I want to focus in on the Sustainable Community Network and the work you're doing with children, because that's really
wonderful.
My passion
wonderful
as well, okay? So we'll just
lovely
take a few minutes and we'll be right back.
All right, very good.
Listening to a progressive moment on the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down or you're just curious, be sure to listen in Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Jim Embry from Lexington, Kentucky, a food activist and community organizer. And Jim, are you there?
I'm back here, dear heart. Lovely, back here.
Great. So, I wanted to focus in a little bit on some of the work you're doing with the youth, both in schools and also in the detention centers, and how you're working with gardening to bring kids, more into the earth and more conscious of each other.
Yes, yes, absolutely. One of the things that we try to tell people are encourage the thinking of people that all humans, all life has come from the earth. The earth is truly our mother. We all of our minerals and vitamins and all that we are, comes from the earth. What that tells us is that there's a whole healing relationship that can go on with our putting our hands literally in the earth, in the ground, working with it, growing things, and having this connection with the earth and growing. And we have, about a year or two ago, Richard Louv, who wrote the book No Child Left Outside, was here, and he helped our community better understand how what we have ascribed as mental problems that kids are having, our behavior problems, ADD, ADHD, and many others, are related to kids not being outside enough and not connecting literally, with the earth. So what we have begun to do is to give various programs in the city, whether they are programs with young people who are either locked up or who have behavior problems in the various schools, or with women. For example, we work real closely with what's called the Christmas House, which is the program for women, many who've been locked up, but who are going through addiction, whether it's alcohol or drug-related. And what they have found is that these women who are going through this addiction program have a their healing rate is enhanced by the whole gardening experience. And many of the women who live at the Christmas House have children, so we know that the women need healing the children do too. So we have a program at the Christmas House. It's a gardening program with the children of the women who are in the program, as well as with the women. And we've been seeing what we call almost some amazing results. But in our view, it ought to be just normal, okay? It ought to be normalized that human beings have this connection with the earth that's very sacred, but also very healing. We also work with various young people. We have an entire garden project. It's called the Drug Court Garden. And these are all young people, again, who have who are going through family and drug court, and they get assigned to this garden every Thursday. And even with the young people there, again, we're finding, again, what's oftentimes called amazing results of young people gaining a sense of civility, gaining a sense of order, responsibility, sense of mission. They have reduced some of their use of medication from being outside and being in the garden, and even being in at times a quiet space in the garden. So we work here in Lexington in about 30 different garden projects. And again, we work in what's called the alternative schools, the schools where kids have what they call behavior problems, and they don't work very well in what's called mainstream school, and there are about three or four of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we work with those schools in garden projects. And again, these young people love to be outside. Okay, they love to work with their hands. They love to see things grow. And what's also occurring is not only is there a healing going on, some of the behavior problems, but there's also a healing in terms of the health condition, because the young people are eating better food. They're recognizing how things grow, and then they've then developed the taste buds for fresh fruit and vegetables that they hadn't had before.
Right, right. You know, I fed about 450 people in a park for Thanksgiving, and in addition to the traditional foods of turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes. We also just did fresh string beans with like a vinaigrette on top, you know, so they were served,
yes,
you know, room temperature. But one woman, she was just so much, she had never had a string bean before, and she just was like,
yes,
you know, she couldn't get enough, and I gave her a whole plate, extra plate of just string beans. Because, you know, many people don't get to have fresh vegetables. And
That's right.
I'm working with an organization on Long Island called Sustainable Long Island, and they are working and trying to address these areas where they're calling them food deserts, areas
right,
where they don't have access to the fresh fruits and vegetables that many of us take for granted. And
exactly,
they're trying to bring some farmers markets to these areas that are underserved by supermarkets. And it's going really great. And I'm sure you have that same situation where you are.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we find food deserts in Kentucky, both in the rural areas as well as in the urban areas. Even people in Kentucky who live in the rural areas and have oftentimes lots of land aren't growing food. They're living off of what's called food, this commodities from the federal government, lots of you know processed food, you know, cheeses and white flours and whatever. So we are, we have programs that we're operating in Appalachia of trying to get people in rural areas to return to this idea of growing food, eating good food, fresh fruit and vegetables, you know, canning food, drying food, eating food seasonally. And like you were describing, we have, with some of our people that we work with, this great discovery. As we had the summer with one of our programs, with the women's programs, these young women were discovering, like tomatoes and peas and yams, and saw how they grew, and they were eating them right off the vine, which they hadn't done before.
Right.
So it's a great, I call it a great remembering of how things used to be in our country back before 1950s when we had victory gardens. There were gardens everywhere. So this is really, really important work, as you were saying, because it addresses so many different problems that we have going on now, whether it's problems of health, of obesity, and diabetes, and heart disease. Those are all related to the kind of food that we're consuming, issues around the ecosystem. As you may know, the USDA has a big campaign going on now to get farmers to grow food more sustainably, because all of the chemicalized and factory model farming systems, as you know, leach out soil through soil erosion and pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers that all hit the various river systems.
And animal waste. All the excretions,
yes,
from the animals.
Yes, and they make their way down the Ohio River, Mississippi River, to the Gulf, and there's this huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and those are all caused by, again, the runoff from various chemicals used in our agricultural systems.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of local food system, sustainable practices of biodynamics and permaculture and organic farming, which means that we're eating better food and we're not impacting the ecosystem.
Right.
So it answers, again, many, many problems that we're faced with.
And does Sustainable Communities Network, do you get involved in addressing public policy?
Well, yes. Every year we sponsor a variety of things, okay? We sponsor every year an annual conference around food systems. This past March, it was called the Bluegrass Food Security Summit. The previous year it was called Closing the Food Gap. We brought in Mark Winnie, who's one of the national speakers around the whole question of developing a food policy council. And we also sponsor every year a garden tour every summer, school garden workshops, community garden workshops, and so forth. But on the policy level, we have been developing, again, for Lexington and Kentucky, what we call a food policy council. Brings together all the various stakeholders to begin to address a much more just and sustainable food system. And I mentioned serving on the local climate action plan, and the purpose of that is to devise objectives and goals that can help us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Well, within that plan, there will be several, goals that will lead to policy changes,
mm-hmm,
that we're working on. Our network, as we say, we try, sometimes we're stretched, but we try to work within every sector of the food system, and we try to give both leadership and just voice and presence and ideas and whatever to every sector.
Uh-huh. And is there a difference between your two organizations, the Sustainable Communities Network and the Bluegrass School and Community Garden Network? Are they like one and the same, or are they two separate entities?
The Bluegrass School Community Garden Network is primarily focused just on the development, of course, of school gardens.
Uh-huh.
And community gardens, okay, just gardening,
uh-huh,
whereby the other network is concerned about and is working in the entire effort around creating sustainable communities.
Uh-huh.
Almost we for example about a year ago sponsored a day-long a workshop on green schools that dealt mostly with the design of schools,
mm-hmm,
both the structure itself as well as the exterior, what we call outdoor learning landscapes. So we had an entire workshop just mostly for architects, designers, school board personnel to address what's the new design, the new thinking around what's called green schools.
Right.
We've also worked in the area of developing rain garden workshops for trying to encourage homeowners, businesses, the faith community to help reduce stormwater runoff through rain gardens and rain barrels and things like that. So, and we also attend, you know, our share of conferences, both, you know, locally, nationally, internationally. We help speak at conferences, help design workshops. So in that sense, then, we're concerned about, as we say, the total, you know, paradigm shift that has to happen to bring us to developing, again, sustainable communities. A paradigm shift is both a shift culturally, politically, economically, spiritually, a tremendous paradigm shift that my friend David Corton calls the Great Turning. The Great Turning, the term of that, which we kind of like got from Joanna Macy, our dear friend Joanna Macy, deep ecologist, said that we're in this great turning, this huge shift, shifting away from 10,000 years of patriarchy, 500 years of the industrial age, and we are literally birthing a new human epoch based upon partnership, sustainability, quantum thinking, what's called cyclical thinking rather than linear thinking,
right.
Things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's, you talk to people like yourself, or I would hope me, you know, and you feel like there's hope. But then, you know, when you start working, at least for me, in some of the organizations where you keep coming up to these same obstacles, you know,
yes.
they're so hard to manage.
Yes.
How do you manage them? Because
well, because, you know, again, part of my background, as we have talked about this before, you know, at least goes back to my great-great-grandfather who fought in the Civil War, okay? He fought in the Civil War, and he died in the Civil War. But his wife and children survived the terrorism that took place after the Civil War. And then one of their children went on to what's called Berea College in Kentucky. In 1879, he was an activist. He inspired my mother to become an activist in 1959. She was the local core president, a civil rights organization, and then that effort inspired me. So what we say is that we've been trying to figure out what it means to be human for thousands of years. And this work today is just a continuum of all that. And that because other people, like during the women's movement in the 60s and 70s, then those women gave a different kind of view of what was possible to women in our country. So we're on a continuum of trying to do all we can within our lifetime to contribute just a little bit to this whole journey of what it means to be human. So I call it pushing elephants uphill.
Perfect.
Okay. Pushing elephants uphill. And at times while you're pushing, the elephants make a mess. So you have to like hold the elephant in place while you're cleaning up the mess. Okay. So you don't lose ground while you're pushing. Now viewing it that way, I can rise every morning and feel joyful. I can feel challenged. I can feel at times irritated, but I never lose hope. I never lose faith. I just feel blessed and thankful that I'm alive today, okay, in 2010, and I can contribute to this great turning.
Right. And what do you do to try to inspire others to bring them along? Because, you know, in one of your quotes, when you talk about apathy from Martin Luther King, you know, that's one of the issues that I see so much around me is people complaining but not wanting to do anything.
How do you
light a fire under all those tushes?
Well, what I do, you know, I try to go back, and I do oftentimes, and center it in quantum thinking by saying that we're all stardust condensed in human form. Okay? So as Stardust, then we're all divine lights. We're all here to be creative. We're all artists, and we're here to be creative. So part of our blessed gift is to be creative, innovative human beings, and that our work is essentially a spiritual path of trying to understand and maintain these sacred earth connections. Okay, so I'll talk to you about that kind of view, that we're all artists, that it wasn't just King who was involved in the movement. It wasn't just individuals who were special, but they were involved with thousands of people. So I try as best I can to give young people and older people just sense that every human being is creative. Every human being should be educated, should be inspired to be an agent of change.
Right. Every single person is an integral part of this whole.
Yes.
And we can't do it without everybody participating.
Yes. Absolutely. And what we try to do, we try to create, if you will, programs, projects that are very interactive. One of the problems we have, as you were addressing the question of apathy, is so much of our educational experiences, you go to school, right, typical K-12, you're told to sit down, be quiet, and you get lectured to for 6 hours.
Right.
Okay?
And no one can learn like that, right?
Right. So we try to create what we call participatory, interactive programs for people to experience, so they can experience how what we do matters. We do a lot of programs with young people in the summertime. It's what's called the Youth Green Corps. We have kids out planting trees, planting rain gardens, and also doing art. We have every year 200 kids that come into Lexington from every county in Kentucky. They come in here for 4 or 5 days, and they do a variety of things, but we have them for an entire day. And what we do is engage them in some discussions about what we call sacred earth connections, sustainability, and food security, and things like that. And then we have them conceptualize and create murals that reflect those kinds of ideas and concepts. But with those young people, we take those murals, we finish them up, and then we coat them to make them waterproof, and then we hang them in the community.
Uh-huh.
That tells young people that what you do matters.
Right.
Okay. So we're looking for again projects to do where young people can use their hands, can use their minds, can be creative, can conceptualize the future, if you will, conceptualize where we're going, and then we find through either murals that we hang in the community, we do all kinds of art from found objects, we have them do poetry, we have them do theater and drama. We use all the arts to enable, again, young people to find their voice, to find their sense of mission, sense of purpose, and through that then move through and beyond what you regarded as the sense of apathy. And one of the ways to combat apathy is to give people an experience where what they do matters.
Right. Well, that's great.
Yes, yes. So every day's full. Every day. I'll tell you that my day kind of chronicles what in the Bible talks about a Bible verse, a Bible prayer. I say, my cup runneth over every day.
Right, and so should everybody's.
Yes.
And then
yes.
We might get somewhere. But
well,
anyway,
yes,
before
yes.
We run out of time, I want you to be able to share with everybody information about your website so that if anybody wants to see what you're
uh-huh.
doing or get in touch with you. And then also I know you have some things coming up in Kentucky that you wanted to share with people, and I also have some things coming up in New York. So,
Great.
You go first.
Yes. I invite our listeners, and I just want to say thanks to all the listeners for supporting Progressive Network Radio. It's important that we support the media. That's what we tend to call alternative, or it's not controlled by large corporations. And just thank all the listeners for being with us tonight and in the future as they look at some of the archives and things like that. But, you know, we say please go to our website, which is sustainlex.org, sustainlex, all one word. Or if you Google Jim Embry, you'll pick up that website and, you know, Facebook and all kind of things. So we're out there pretty broadly.
And this weekend we're both celebrating Terra Madre Day, which is a national day of celebration.
Yes. There are thousands of events going on worldwide, Terra Madre Day, and we're celebrating it on Saturday, mostly at our Good Foods Co-op here in Lexington. I'm speaking there at 10 about my experience, of course, at Terra Madre the last two times. We're having exhibits. We're showing movies, the dirt.
And then you have a potluck, and we're doing ours on Friday, also with potluck.
Lovely. Yes,
anyway, we're out of time, and we're getting we need to say goodnight to everybody. And it's been wonderful to have you, Jim. Thanks so much, and I look forward to
my pleasure
celebrating in person again. Okay, have a great day. Bye.